This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. Diplomats from Russia, Iran, and Turkey have been unable to agree on the makeup of a UN-sponsored Syrian Constitutional Committee. They did call for it to convene early next year, aimed at a peace process to end Syria's nearly 8-year war. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and his Iranian and Turkish counterparts issued a joint statement after meeting outgoing UN Syria envoy Stefani Mistura.
The work of the Constitutional Committee should be governed by a sense of compromise and constructive engagement aimed at reaching general agreement of its members, which would enable the outcome to receive the widest possible support by the Syrian people.
But there was no mention made of the composition of that committee, suggesting continuing disagreement over the proposed list of candidates submitted by Damascus and the rebels. DeMistura acknowledged the three countries were unable to reach a workable political forum after years of effort to end a war that has killed hundreds of thousands and displaced millions. In the words of the UN envoy, there is an extra mile to go.
In the marathon effort to ensure the necessary package for a credible, balanced, and inclusive constitutional committee, and for including a balanced chairing arrangement and drafting body and voting threshold.
DeMistura, in his post for 4 years, has tried to seal a deal on the identity of the 150 participants in the committee. He is to step down December 31st. The UN Security Council has called on all parties to reject violence to ensure a transparent, peaceful, and credible outcome to Sunday's presidential election in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It urged all sides to reject violence of any kind, exercise maximum restraint, and refrain from provocation. Voters are to choose a successor to President Joseph Kabila in what's expected to be the country's first peaceful, democratic transition. This is VOA News. Outgoing U.S.-UN Ambassador Nikki Haley Tuesday hinted the much-anticipated U.S. Mideast peace plan for Israel and the Palestinians will bring new elements to the discussion and take advantage of a new world of technology.
Unlike previous attempts at addressing this conflict, this plan is not just a few pages containing unspecific and unimaginative guidelines. It is much longer. It contains much more thoughtful detail.
Haley, who said she's read it, offered no details of exactly what's in the plan, believed to have been 2 years in the making. She said Palestinians have everything to gain by engaging in peace negotiations. Saudi Arabia said it plans to increase state spending next year by 7% to spur growth hurt by low oil prices. Spending is projected to rise to an all-time high of nearly $300 billion. Finance Minister Mohammed Al-Jadan said revenues estimated to increase 9%, with debt deficit falling over 4% of gross domestic product. The level of public debt will rise more than 20%. The Saudi economy grew more than 2% this year, but not enough to put a dent in the jobless rate, which hovers near 13%. The UN is expected Wednesday to convene Yemen's warring factions by video link to discuss the redeployment of all forces from the port city of Hodeidah, where a UN-brokered ceasefire went into effect Tuesday. The Saudi coalition-backed government and Houthi rebels have agreed in Sweden to the truce, a confidence-building measure designed to pave the way toward a political settlement. The Trump administration has given a travel ban waiver to a Yemeni mother to travel to the U.S. to be with her dying 2-year-old son. Robert Palladino is a State Department spokesman.
These are decided on a case-by-case basis, and we are committed to following United States administration law and ensuring the integrity and security of our country's borders, and at the same time, making every effort to facilitate legitimate travel to the United States.
Seamus Swilla plans to fly to San Francisco Wednesday. Her son, Abdullah, suffers from a genetic brain disorder. 11 crew members abducted by pirates off Nigeria's coast in October are said to be safe and will be reunited with their families. 8 of the crewmen are Poles, and the announcement came from the Polish Foreign Ministry. The crew members were kidnapped from the container vessel MV Pomerania Sky. The number of journalists killed this year is 53 so far. The Committee to Protect Journalists said that compares to 47 documented in 2017. The U.S. Central Bank Wednesday will end its final policymaking meeting of the year in Washington and is expected to hold the line on a key interest rate, which has already been raised 3 times this year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A commission of inquiry in Zimbabwe faults the military and the police for the deaths of six people last August.
The use of live ammunition was clearly unjustified and disproportionate. The use of shamboks, baton sticks, and rifle butts to assault members of the public indiscriminately was also disproportionate.
Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe, the main opposition MDC, says it is time to get the military out of Zimbabwe politics. An opposition leader resigns from the government as a teacher strike continues in Guinea-Conakry. Uganda's president proposes a national dialogue, and the Malawi opposition party chooses the current vice president as its presidential candidate.
So Rasalus Chilima was elected the president, which means he is going to be the top player of the party in the next year's presidential election.
Joseph Chidante Mulonga is the director of publicity of the opposition United Transformation Movement Party of Malawi. And African art restitution gains traction in France. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe, the commission of inquiry set up by the government to look into last August post-election violence released its report late Tuesday. The commission was chaired by former South African President Halima Molante. Six people were killed when police fired live bullets at opposition supporters who were protesting the delay in releasing the results of the July 30th presidential election. In one of the findings, the report said the army and police used unjustified and disproportionate force. The generals who testified before the commission had denied that soldiers were responsible for the deaths of the protesters. Here's President Emmerson Mnangagwa with some of the findings.
While the deployment was lawful, the operational framework in terms of Section 57, subsection 2 of POSA was not followed in that the deployed troops were not placed under the command of the regulatory authority due to time constraints as acknowledged by the Commissioner General of Police. Whether the degree of force used was proportionate to the ensuing threat to public safety, law and order, given that property and lives were under threat at various locations, and in light of the inability of the police to disperse the protesters, the firing by the army and the police of warning shots in the air in pursuit of their stated mission, which was to clear the CBD of violent protesters, was proportionate. However, the use of live ammunition directed the people, especially when they were fleeing, was clearly unjustified and disproportionate. The use of shamboks, baton sticks, and rifle butts to assault members of the public indiscriminately was also disproportionate.
That was President Emmerson Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe. He says his government will study the report before deciding what to do. An opposition leader in Zimbabwe says the fundamental problem in the country is the takeover of civilian politics by the military. Welsh Mahumbe, vice president of the opposition movement for democratic change, MDC, says the military has taken over the ruling ZANU-PF and state institutions. He was reacting to the findings of the commission of inquiry set up by the Zimbabwe government to look into last August post-election violence. The report said the army and police used unjustified and disproportionate force, resulting in the deaths of six people. Mumbe says, although the opposition received the report late Tuesday, nevertheless, it welcomes the findings. He said what matters now is what action will be taken to ensure that it doesn't happen again.
Let me start by saying that we are still studying the report. We only just received copies of the report yesterday afternoon. But we, of course, welcome the finding that the use of live ammunition was unjustified, and that given that the protesters were in fact shot from the back by and large, that use of force was disproportionate. We welcome that. It is something that every rational person has always known.
In that light, in terms of what is going to be done, the report recommends that the soldiers and police who broke codes of conduct should face internal discipline. Is that fair, or do you think that they should face maybe a court proceeding?
Well, given the patently dishonest evidence which was being proffered by the command element of, in particular, the military to the commission, clearly there are no prospects that any internal disciplinary processes, even if they are court-martial proceedings, will in any way be done fairly and properly. The only fairest way would for these individuals, both at command level as well as at execution level, to actually face the full wrath of the law of the normal, ordinary criminal courts of the country.
The report seems to also blame the opposition, saying that opposition leaders incited violence ahead of the deployment of the military and the police.
Well, every fair-minded person would, of course, accept that at some point the demonstrations born out of the frustrations and the fears that the electoral process was manipulated, degenerated into violence. So I frankly do not believe that it is correct, it is proper to find that the opposition incited anyone to demonstrate, let alone to commit acts of violence. What will be fair is a conclusion that, yes, those demonstrations turned violent, but the opposition had no role, direct or indirect, in inciting or in any way doing anything at the behest of the opposition to make any demonstration.
The fact that even President Emmerson Mnangagwa read this portion of the report criticizing the police and the army, is this a sign of some openness in Zimbabwe?
I think it is important to acknowledge the wrongs that were done by the military in this instance. What now matters is to wait and see what action will be taken to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. But more importantly, over and above what the commission has said, what we have as a fundamental problem in this country is the takeover of civilian politics by the military. So our biggest challenge as a country is how will we ever be able to get the military back in the barracks, not just in the physical sense, but in the political sense. Our military at the moment, with the greatest respect, has taken over the ruling party, has taken over state institutions, and direct the conduct of politics in this country. And that is the biggest challenge, how to take them back to the barracks.
Mr. Mbe, thank you very much for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, sir.
Washma Umbe is Vice President of the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change in Zimbabwe. He was speaking with me from the capital, Harare. Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni says he is ready to dialogue with opposition political parties in the country. He says national dialogue is paramount for the stability and prosperity of the nation. Justice James Ogula, the retired principal judge of the High Court of Uganda, says dialogue is not an option, but rather a must in order for Uganda as a nation to heal what he called its bad past as well as shape the future. Mugumi Davis Rakarinj reports from Kampala.
Speaking Tuesday in Kampala at the launch of the national dialogue, Mr. Museveni said he has, in two quotes, been dying for this dialogue so people from different divide can be able to discuss their views.
If you are sectarian, I'm not with you. Sorry, and I'm here to tell you that I will not be with you. I have never been with you. I will not be with you. So this dialogue is good without violating the Constitution. Only you must be very careful about that. We cannot violate the Constitution. This dialogue, we shall see how we move.
President Museveni came to power more than 3 decades ago through a coup d'etat. He has on 5 occasions contested and won elections, although the opposition has always claimed election irregularities. Mr. Museveni said the national dialogue is important for socioeconomic transformation and democracy of the country. The national dialogue will be spearheaded by the Religious Council and Elders Forum. Speaking at the same function, retired Justice James Ogola, chairman of the Elders Forum, outlined some of the issues that he said will be discussed during the national dialogue.
Our national diversity, we need a consensus on that. Our national values, land and natural resources, a very fundamental topic for the nation to ponder and agree a consensus.
The dialogue will discuss constitutionalism and the rule of law. It will be headed by a committee whose members will be selected from the government, political parties, religious leaders, the civil society, the youth and women. Ogola said the dialogue will help give direction to the future of the nation.
We aim high, we aim noble. From the ashes that have characterized our history, this power of Africa aims to rise to glorious heights in the future. From yesterday's nightmare of our bloody past, we aim to awaken to the bell of liberty. Today, we take the arc of yesteryear's history and bend it from the night of nightmare into the bright day of beauty and promise.
Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, has shied away from attending the proposed dialogue, saying it is meant to promote the current regime. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Today is Wednesday, December 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Malawi's opposition United Transformation Movement, UTM Party, has officially elected Vice President Saulos Chilima as its presidential candidate in next year's general election. His election came after he accused the government of planning to assassinate him before next year's polls. But Minister for Homeland Security Nicholas Dawusi has rejected the claim, saying Chilima is protected by round-the-clock security. Chilima's election pits him against incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika, who handpicked Chilima as his running mate in the 2014 elections on the Democratic People's Party DPP ticket. But Chilima fell out with the president after accusing the government of corruption. He then resigned from the ruling DPP to form the UTM party. Joseph Chidante Malunga is director of publicity for the UTM.
It is true that we had a convention yesterday, and all we did was to legitimize the positions and also give the UTM the mandate to participate in the next year's presidential elections. And Dr. Saulos Chilima was elected the president, which means he is going to be the torchbearer of the party. And several other people were also elected. As you know, that this event is very important because that's where you're given the mandate for the people to lead the party.
Joseph, there were initial local media reports that some local representatives, although they were interim, left the party over dispute, some over money. Do you think by this election, all these alleged or reported divisions have been resolved?
There were no divisions at all. I mean, in the politics, people pass on anything and they just talk whatever they want in order to manage the image of the other. But there were no divisions whatsoever. What I know is that some people that at the internet position decided not to contest. And this is because they say, okay, we want to give chances to the other people that are new for the newness. So we cannot reach newness when some of the members are not able, cannot get up at their position. So that's what it is. We think we need newness. So the guys that are out there, people that don't have friends in politics, can you contest? And we stand aside and we work. Whenever you need us, if you need our advice, we will be available for you. I don't think that would be bad for the policy. In fact, it's good for our party that something we can do. In fact, that's what we're going to do.
During the election, there were some people who were unopposed, and some of your critics are saying that does not show the tenet of internal democracy in the UTM. How do you respond to that?
This is the politics. People will look for any legal way that they see in the black economy and capitalize on that.
I mean, being an airport doesn't mean that there's no democracy. I mean, these positions were advertised 3 weeks prior, and everyone knew about it. They were in every major newspaper in this country. They were on the social media, they were on the radio, they were everywhere, really. And people were keeping it that. If you don't open the election, that's when you say it's a contract. But when you open up and allow people to actually apply, if people didn't apply, I mean, how are you going to feel someone to say, come on, apply for this position? Is that how it is? That's not how it is.
So let me ask you, what do you think are the realistic chances of the UTM's presidential candidate, Salos Chilima, in next year's election? And is there a room for a possible alliance in the run-up to the election?
We are open. We can work with anybody with the same ideology as we have. But I think the question is how. The question is how is that probably everyone else is looking forward to. So if we go into partnership, what kind of partnership is this going to be? How is it going to take all of that?
Joseph Chidante Malunga is the Director of Publicity for Malawi's opposition United Transformation Movement Party. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. A strike by public school teachers in Guinea-Conakry has been going on now for more than 2 months. The teachers are demanding an $800 a year salary increase, but the government of President Alpha Conde says it will not negotiate with the teachers because their demand is unaffordable. Meanwhile, students have been out of school for more than 2 months now and their school year is in jeopardy. An opposition leader who went on a hunger strike to support the teachers has ended his strike with no positive results. Sidia Touré is the leader of the Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party. He joined the government but then quit. He explains why.
We don't have any possibility, you know, to implement what decision we have to help really to go forward and to increase the revenue for people in Guinea. So I think that in 3 years was just enough.
I remember when I talked with you, when you decided to accept that position, you had hope that you will contribute to bringing about changes. Are you saying Absolutely. That there's been no possibility of enacting any positive change in Guinea?
Absolutely, this is what I'm thinking. And the problem is more important than I think because it's a real problem for leadership.
In the meantime, Mr. Touré, there has been a teacher strike for months now in Guinea. There doesn't seem to be a solution. Was that part of your decision to resign?
Because, you know, it's 1 month and a half we have this strike. And I tried to have a discussion with the teachers and I asked to the government to have a discussion because the more important thing we can have in underdeveloped country like Guinea is to be sure that our education will go in the good direction. And I have no answer from the government about that. So kids are in the street during 1 month and a half. I think this is absolutely unacceptable. This is one of the reasons, too.
But the government says that the demand of the teachers, the pay raise that the teachers are requesting, is unaffordable.
Absolutely, but you go to discuss, and maybe you say, this is what I can do. But saying that we'll have no discussion with nobody, I think this is not a good responsibility for the government. We have to go to discussion and be sure that we can do something, or you cannot do more. You can do, I don't know, 10%, 5%, 1%, I don't know. But this is not the solution we have.
So what's next now for you, Mr. Touré?
I will try to explain to the people that we need a change of leadership in this country. This is very important, and the next election will be in 2020. And I'm trying to work with my party to go forward. But the next step will be the Congress election. We're preparing that for next year.
Sidia Touré is the leader of the Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party. You're speaking with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. New momentum in France to return artifacts dubiously acquired during the colonial era has sparked growing restitution claims in Africa, with the West African country of Benin expected to be the first beneficiary. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
In the shadow of the Eiffel Tower, the Quai Branly Museum hosts France's biggest collection of indigenous art from Africa, Oceania, Asia, and the Americas. An estimated 70,000 of its roughly 300,000 artifacts come from Africa. But for how long will Quai Branly be able to keep them? That's a question facing French museums housing African artifacts, some taken by French soldiers and civilians during colonial days. A report released last month argues they should be permanently returned to their places of origin.
On est dans un temps qui est beaucoup plus opportun pour que l'on avance sur cette question-là, parce que cette question relève aussi d'un impensé.
Senegalese economist Félouin Sarr co-authored the report with a French historian. In a recent interview on French radio, Sarr argues that after decades of discussion and dispute, the time for returning African art is ripe. African youth has a right to reconnect with its patrimony, he says, just like young people everywhere else in the world.
Le patrimoine africain ne peut pas être uniquement dans des collections privées et des musées européens.
French President Emmanuel Macron commissioned the report after promising during a visit last year to Burkina Faso to temporarily or permanently return African artifacts taken during colonial days. The government has taken a first step in making good this promise, with plans to return 26 royal artifacts taken from West Africa's ancient Dahomey Kingdom in the 19th century to what is now Benin.
So those 26 are very important objects. Even though the number seems very small, the 26 are the pieces that come directly from the Royal Palace in Abomey.
Marie-Cécile Zazou is president of the Zazou Foundation in Benin and among Africa's most vocal restitution advocates. A decade ago, her private museum hosted an exhibition on Dahomey art, borrowing the pieces from France. More than a quarter of a million people flocked to see them.
If Benin succeeds in showing the heritage, if they make it, I think everything will change. Like this, we have a real example of how African countries are getting their heritage back and how they're showing it to the public.
Experts estimate up to 90% of African antiquities are located outside the continent. That includes in France, with an estimated 90,000 pieces, mostly housed at Quai Branly Museum. Benin was the first Francophone country to formally ask for its artifacts back. Now the demands are growing, with officials in Senegal, Ivory Coast, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Chad saying they are ready or interested in making restitution claims. New or renovated museums are also sprouting across Africa, countering arguments that the continent cannot properly house its heritage. Other European countries are caught up in the debate. The British Museum promised to return priceless bronzes to Nigeria, and Germany is helping Kenya track stolen artifacts. At the same time, a new Berlin museum has sparked controversy for pieces acquired from former German colonies. And there are still plenty of European critics who argue against permanently returning African artifacts to Africa. Benin's Marie-Cécile Zazou dismisses the skeptics.
I think as soon as we'll show people how it works, people will understand why it's so important for Africa to have its heritage back.
After independence, Zazou said, African countries were forced to prioritize basics like roads and schools. Now it's time, she says, for Africa to preserve its cultural identity. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. In Zimbabwe, the Commission of Inquiry set up by the government to look into last August post-election violence released its report late Tuesday. The commission said the army and police used unjustified and disproportionate force in which six people died. And that is it for this Wednesday, December 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington wishing you a good day.
The 2019 Voice of America calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture the beautiful byways of the United States, including magnificent photos of California's Big Sur Coast Highway, West Virginia's Highland Scenic Highway, and even the Cato All-American Road in Maine. Tune into Border Crossings and call to request a free calendar.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
Nigeria is preparing for general elections in February 2019.
President Muhammadu Buhari is running on an ambitious anti-corruption agenda. But opposition leader Atiku Abubakar believes the president has neglected the economy. An in-depth discussion on Nigeria's future.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.